Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Mourners passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March 3rd, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons hung their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom is the rising of the moon.
Here we are for podcast number 6 in the Radio Free Northwest series. I've gotten a few complaints about my talking too fast in past podcasts, and yeah, on listening into them, I think sometimes I do come across as a bit of a motor mouth, but that motor mouth effect is at least partly due to the sound editing that I have learned to perform on my WavePad program to cut out all the E's and uhs and ers and the coughing and the heavy breathing and the lip smacking and so forth. Nonetheless, it's a valid point, and I'll try to work on my delivery and improve the overall presentation in the future. Now, our first question for part one of this podcast is from Ed Peacock in North Carolina, and it reads as follows. Dear Harold, in your monologue on paranoia last week, you talked about exercising a few simple precautions to deal with paranoia in our day-to-day lives and in our racial work, but you were short on specifics. What simple precautions were you referring to? Good point, Ed. You're right. I did mention that, and then I went off rambling and lost the thread of what I was talking about, which is another problem I need to watch on these broadcasts. Okay, call these a few simple and reasonable security precautions to keep white racial activists functioning in society. Number one, my recommendation is that you avoid big meetings, fests, conferences, where anybody with a pale skin can just walk in the door. The FBI and the SPLC love big racial and right-wing meetings to death. Now, these events are happy hunting grounds for every kind of police agent, undercover reporter, or filmmaker looking to write smear stories on us, and also for every kind of left-wing private monitoring group spy you can imagine. These meetings in compounds or in rented motel banquet rooms are where most of our people first get onto the enemy databases. They get their license plates jotted down in the parking lot, they get identified and maybe photographed in a conference hall or on some compound or whatever by the cameras with the long-range telephoto lenses, and from then on, they're in the system, and one day being in the system may kill you. The enemy wants to know who we are. They want us in the database as preparation for that great day in the future when they can finally round us all up. That's the big wet dream for the FBI and Morris Dees and Mark Potok. They want to do to any white person, only right of center, what was done to people of German, Italian, and Japanese descent during World War II. People like Obama and Pelosi and Dees want us all in camps where no doubt our brains can be washed squeaky clean. And if that sounds like paranoia, I repeat, read your history books. They did it once before in 1941, and they're doing it now to naturalized U.S. citizens of Arab descent. They have the laws on the books now, like the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and one day, they're finally going to spring the master plan and carry out the dream of all tyrants, to lock up their opposition in prison. Alexander Solzhenitsyn called these people the organs of state security, or just the organs, and that's what I call them. FBI, Secret Service, DHS, CIA, BATFE, U.S. Marshals, and all the other spy agencies. And that includes the so-called private ones like ADL and the SPLC. Now, once the organs get a name and a photograph, they start a file on you, and you're in the database forever. Now, to be sure, most of us listening to this little podcast already have government and SPLC files on us, but that doesn't mean that we need to help them keep those files up to date. Make the bastards work. Put them to some effort. History proves that the best revolutionary results are always obtained by small autonomous groups, cells, whose members know each other and trust one another from experience. Yeah, most revolutions end up with mobs in the street in their final phase, but putting those mobs in the street is the work of many years of preparation by those small cells I just mentioned. Whether the Northwest Revolution or War of Independence will ever include a mobs in the street phase, I don't know, but I kind of doubt it. The fact is that American whites have been pretty much engineered out of the whole street mob mentality. But we'll see how that works out when the time comes. Now, getting back to my primer on paranoid practices, secondly, like my old movement mentor, Pastor Bob Miles, used to tell me, never write down or say on the telephone anything you wouldn't want read out in open court, because it probably will be. Nowadays, that applies to emails, chat rooms, podcasts like this, and all the other paraphernalia of the internet. Always assume that your electronic communications are being monitored and recorded by the organs of state security, and be aware of the fact that you may find yourself sitting in a courtroom someday, listening to your own words being played back to you. Now, when you're online or on the phone, assume that it's all for the record. Condition yourself never to say anything that might give the enemy an excuse to defunctionalize you, and then simply drive on. This is the 21st century. Practically speaking, we have no choice. We have to communicate with one another, and we have to use electronic means to do so. Choosing our words carefully and sanitizing our emails and telephone conversations needs to become second nature for us all. Point number three. At this time in the struggle, you should assume that anyone who proposes illegal activities, or just as importantly, anyone who refuses to shut up about illegal activities, is a cop. He's either a cop or he is someone who is so mentally unstable or so bird-brained stupid that he cannot recognize the difference between my fiction and reality, and so he's just as dangerous to have around. On more than one occasion in my career, I've seen men and women go to prison not for doing anything, not even for saying anything, but for simply being in the same room with somebody who would not shut up about planting bombs or assassinating people or blowing up bridges, whatever, and it turned out there was a funny little man over in the corner with a funny little tape recorder beneath his coat, and we know what happens then. One of these days I might tell you guys about the Asheville 6 case back in 1980, which is one of the prime examples of the very thing I'm talking about. Point number four. Avoid drunks, drug users, and anyone who is clearly mentally and emotionally unstable. Okay, this is 2010, and let's face it, almost all white people are a little dysfunctional these days. Goes with the territory of living in a completely unnatural world. But you need to stay away from people who are really badly damaged, and it usually doesn't take too long to figure out who those are. Always choose quality over quantity. Never try to get mileage out of creeps. Historically, that is one of the worst mistakes movement groups have ever made, and I know because I've made that mistake a few times myself. Point number five. Know the ground rules, insofar as there are any, which in our case isn't very far. You need to understand that you are white, and that means that in politically correct society, you have no rights. Always be aware of the fact that white nationalists are a persecuted minority without any real legal protection in this society, and we are pretty much at the mercy of the regime and its agents. And they will, in the end, do to us whatever the hell they feel like doing. And why should they not? White men no longer have any deterrent. Why should they not arrest us, frame us, torture us in jail, crucify us with their judicial system, send us to prison for non-existent crimes, destroy our families and destroy our lives? Who's going to stop them? Not us. But let's be honest, framing and persecuting and destroying so-called white supremacists is the safest thing the government and the private liberal vigilante groups do. They put Glenn Miller in the witness protection program for many years, true, but that was just for show, to make him more credible as a witness to dumbass juries, which they failed to do, by the way. I think we all know that Glenn was never in any danger, despite testifying in two capital cases against his own people. Now, the government and its enforcement agencies are not going to play fair with you. Morris Dees and Abe Foxman and Mark Potok are not going to play fair with you. There is an old Sicilian proverb, never ask for what you can't take. The old Constitution is gone. Bush threw it out the window and Obama pissed on it down in the alley where it fell. We have only whatever rights we can force these people to grant us. Lacking any deterrent, lacking any way to compel the government and the police and the private liberal monitoring groups to respect our right to differ from them and respect our right to dissent and to think for ourselves, all we can do is go crawling on our bellies to these people with our tails thumping between our legs, begging these people to show us mercy, to be kind, and give us our rights. Look around you and see how well that's working out for us. Even as I speak these words, the Democratic Party is about to ram socialized medicine down the throats of white America and hand 1/6 of the U.S. economy over to themselves through the use of a parliamentary trick called reconciliation, and this after white America has spent the past year making it abundantly clear that we don't want it. All the town hall meetings and the tea parties and the faxes to congressmen and the phone calls to Rush Limbaugh are simply being ignored. As Barack Hussein Obama and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid extend their middle fingers and say, "Screw you, America." Now tell me again about all these rights we supposedly have. Tell me again what a great free country this is supposed to be. Until such time as white men decide that their honor and their self-respect demands that they once again be willing to incur personal risk and danger in order to take back our rights from those who will never give them to us willingly, then we have none. Okay, music break yet? Now let's do another question from someone who describes himself as a well-known VNN poster. And since VNN people aren't supposed to be in direct contact with me, and he doesn't want to get in trouble and maybe banned or sent to the Nutspaw Lounge or Tard Corral or whatever, he asks that he remain anonymous. Okay, fair enough. Anonymous VNN guy's question is, "Dear Mr. Covington, I notice in the Northwest Republic's Constitution that you post on your website that you include in your Bill of Rights the right to free medical care. That sounds suspiciously socialist. How does this differ from the Obamacare that's about to be rammed through Congress?" Okay, let's answer that in several parts. To begin with, I need to remind all of you that the draft constitution dated October 2006, which is published in the party handbook and on the party website, is just that. It is a draft. The actual form that the constitution of the new Northwest Republic will take will be decided at the appropriate time by a constitutional convention consisting of those who have brought the Northwest Republic into being, just as was done before. Remember, the United States Constitution wasn't created until 1787, 6 years after the end of the First American Revolution. Now, this draft we have now is not just something that Harold made up. It was created through actual consultation with many individual people, including some of the order prisoners, and including David Lane himself during its early stages. The Northwest Constitution as it now stands is meant to give us some kind of benchmark as to exactly what it is we're fighting for, and to show white people that we're not just a bunch of crazy guys with shaven heads and tattoos, but that we do in fact have real ideas for an alternative to politically correct society. But it is only a draft, a series of suggestions, if you will. It's not chiseled in stone. When the time comes, the veterans of the revolutionary struggle, whatever form that struggle may take, are going to have to sit down around a table or in the National Convention and decide for certain exactly what kind of government the white people of the homeland want. A lot of how that turns out is going to depend on how we finally end up attaining our independence and what the world of that time will be like, but that's another topic. All that having been said, a lot of what the Northwest Republic's constitution was designed to do was to correct a variety of abuses and injustices which have crept into American constitutional law over the past 230 years. A good example is eliminating the entire judicial branch of government so that the courts are reduced to their proper function of being finders of fact and not interpreters of law. And so we won't have a Supreme Court messing around with the Constitution like the nine old swine in D.C. have been doing for the past 100 years. Another of those injustices is that we have here today in America a situation where a working white family can lose their house if grandma or another family member gets sick. Private health insurance is disappearing, along with employment in this country. You can be sure that if the millions of white Americans who are now out of work ever do manage to get rehired at some job or other, it will be with substantially reduced medical insurance or no medical insurance at all, because private employers are getting ready to dump all their employees off onto Obamacare once Reid and Pelosi ram it through by misusing budget reconciliation, which should be in a few weeks' time. Why should employers pay for health insurance for their employees if the government provides it? The fact that the government won't be providing anything for at least 5 years means nothing to capitalists. They're going to dump all their people off onto a largely unproven and non-existent government health service long before it even exists. We really need to keep in mind that as bad as Marxism and liberalism are, capitalism is just the flip side of the same poisonous coin. As things stand right now, when grandma gets sick or mommy gets cancer, if the head of the household and other family members make too much money, then they're not eligible for what little government help is available, Medicare or Medicaid. White males aren't eligible for these programs anyway, which are run by the states. I know because I myself have tried to get on to the local version of Medicaid in both Washington and Oregon, and I was turned down by both states on grounds of my race and my gender. They didn't quite put it like that directly, of course. What they specifically told me was that I did not fit into one of the 15 or 16 eligibility categories. Of course, it just so happens that all of the eligibility categories apply solely to women, children, and racial minorities. The only way a white male can be eligible for medical insurance is to be actually blind, physically disabled, or over 65, which lets out most of us middle-aged white boys. What got me was that in Oregon, at least, illegal aliens are specifically included in one eligibility category, and don't get me started on that. Some years ago, one young black girl working for the Washington State version of Medicaid, Washington Basic Health, I think it's called, was refreshingly honest with me when I applied. She told me, "Mr. Covington, men of your demographic," by which she meant middle-aged white males, she said, "men of your demographic are supposed to be paying for this program, not drawing benefits from it." She wasn't being mean or racist to me, she was just simply telling me the facts of life, and I appreciated her honesty. Okay, I'm rambling again, so I'll try to get back on track. That provision in the Northwest Constitution is meant to prevent the situation which I and so many of our people face right now, and that is we are being denied medical care because we have no money. Don't ever let anyone tell you that no one is ever turned away from needed medical care in this country because they're poor. I know that's not true because it's been done to me in the past, and no doubt will be again. I won't go off into a long Grandpa Simpson-like rave. I'm not lying. Poor white people most certainly are turned away because they have no money, because I've had it happen to me. In the Northwest American Republic, in a white nation, a white homeland, that must not, will not, ever happen. Not to anybody, man, woman, or child, period, end of story. And if it means that in the Northwest Republic, doctors won't drive Porsches and live in 30-room mansions and spend their weekends on the golf course at the country club, then so be it. We will train our own doctors, paramedics, and healthcare professionals and make sure we instill in them motivations and ethics having to do with helping sick and injured people and not ringing the chink, chink, ching of a cash register. It's things like this that sometimes tempt me to give in to the urge to start on the fifth Northwest novel I mentioned a few weeks ago, the one that follows the first 50 years of the Northwest Republic's existence and explains just how all these problems could be and should be worked out. But again, that's just a digression, so I'll stick to the point. I will conclude by saying this. Like every other issue on this continent, the healthcare issue is immensely complicated by and intertwined with the issues of race. Obamacare is essentially a program to transfer wealth away from people with white skins and into the pockets of people with dark skins in the form of free medical care. In an all-white society, that problem would not apply. I can tell you that because I've actually lived in an all-white society, which was probably at the time the last remaining all-white society in the world except for Iceland. And that is Ireland back in the 1980s. I can tell you from personal experience that in an all-white society, a single-payer healthcare system works. My wife had two babies, and we all had the usual problems with childhood diseases and so on. I think there was something like a £5 copayment for a doctor visit and a couple of quid for prescriptions, and that was it. And if you had a full medical card, even the copayments were dropped. It's only when you get into a situation like California, where something like half the emergency room treatments are to non-paying illegal aliens who give false names and then disappear, combined with incredibly greedy pharmaceutical companies, and it's then you start having problems. Okay, first music break. I'm in a bit of a southern mood here, and you guys seem to like last week's banjo piece, so here's Tony Ellis with Doc Mongol's Blues. Thank you. Now we get into one of the more important rants I'm going to be inflicting on you guys via the medium of these podcasts. This is so important that I would appreciate it if you guys would download this file and retain it for future reference and pass it around to others on the internet, as much hassle as that may be, sending a file this huge. There are places like Sendspace.com that you can use to upload huge files like this, and then you send the URL they give you to other people who can then go to the website and download it from there. That way you don't have to email the file as an attachment and get it rejected by your ISP due to it being over their limit. I'm going to talk now about one of the most important subjects that we in the Northwest, and indeed white revolutionaries everywhere, are going to have to be dealing with in the next few years, and that is our relationship with conservatives. I don't mean established neocons or talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. I mean real white people. Grassroots conservatives, Tea Party types, from whom we will be drawing a very large number of our recruits here in the Northwest Front. Both we on the radical end of things and they on their end need to understand who we both are and what the situation is that we face and why we need one another's help. First off, what are we talking about here? Commander Rockwell once said, "A National Socialist is someone who is concerned about his race. A conservative is only concerned about his money." That pretty much hits the nail on the head. Not just National Socialism, but Christian identity and all kinds of genuinely revolutionary white concepts are concerned with race, with the effects of race on every issue from culture to religion to politics to science. Not just economics. Race is the American issue and has been since Columbus first landed on that Caribbean island and chucked his flagpole into the sand on the beach and claimed the New World for the King and Queen of Spain. The basic issue of whose land this is. An American conservative may have the odd social issue on his agenda, like abortion or prayer in the schools or whatever, and most likely he's against gun control and gay marriage, but the fact remains that primarily he simply doesn't want to be taxed in order to support non-white minorities with black and brown skins. He has to work, he never had anything given to him in his life, and he doesn't see why people with black and brown skins should get a free ride on his back. We are often reminded that our ancestors revolted against Britain over a simple tax on tea, and while that's a gross oversimplification of the situation in 1776, it's close enough for our purposes. It's humanly understandable, of course, nobody likes paying taxes, but to view life through any economics-only perspective is essentially a Jewish construct. Remember what I've said in the past about the essence of the Jewish worldview being pure materialism, not spiritual, not political, not moral, not human. You also need to understand that in the American context, there are several different kinds of conservatives. The two that we need to be concerned about now are what's known as paleoconservatives and neoconservatives. Paleoconservatives are your old red, white, and blue Pat Buchanan and Sam Francis types. They believe in limited government, states' rights, strict construction of the Constitution, unrestricted free enterprise, your basic laissez-faire capitalism. These are the guys who would have been right at home during the presidency of William McKinley in 1900. The neoconservatives are basically Jews pretending to be conservatives. People like Irving Kristol and the whole goo-boo Jew crew who took over the White House for 8 years when Jug Ears Bush was president. The spiritual founder of neoconservatism, in fact, was a Jewess named Ayn Rand, whose real name was Elisa Rosenbaum. I think most of you listening to this will be sufficiently familiar with what I'm talking about, so I don't have to go off into a long spiel about who's what and why and all the details. You can get all that info from other sources. But the conservative types who concern us here in the Northwest are not these ideological guru types from the think tanks who argue about how many mattoids can dance on the head of a pin. They're part of the establishment. The ones we need to be concerned with are those who are not part of the establishment. The ordinary white people who have emerged from these town hall meetings and tea parties over this past year. They represent something that has not been seen in this country for a long time, not really since the Wallace for President campaign of 1968. They're a genuine grassroots movement of white resistance against the tyranny from Washington, D.C. Mostly against the forced imposition of socialized medicine in the form of Obamacare, but also because more and more white Americans have come to realize that somehow, they're not quite sure how, a ghastly mistake was made on November the 4th, 2008, and there are now people ruling them who do not have their best interests at heart, and who want to rob them and take away their freedom in ways that they would never have believed possible before. I'll refer to these people as Tea Partiers because it's a convenient handle, although many of them probably have never attended one of these Tea Party meetings or rallies. They're very uneasy and upset about the way that the country and the government in Washington, D.C. are moving, but they are still expressing themselves mostly in economic terms, at least in public. The racial undertone is definitely there, though, because for the first time ever, government oppression now has a black face in the form of Obama. This has brought about a very subtle change in conservatism that it's no longer quite so forbidden to mention or at least hint at race. The liberal media jump all over anyone who does bring it up, of course, but I don't think that's having the same effect it used to have. It's quite obviously just a ploy to shut people up by designating any criticism of Obama and the Democrats as racism, and it's so obvious that I think it really just pisses people off and makes them much less susceptible to running and hiding under the bed when somebody utters the word racist, and that's a very encouraging development. What's really going on, and what's really going to open the can of worms, is that the next big item on the Democrat agenda after Obamacare is going to be so-called immigration reform. In other words, amnesty for the 25 to 30 million or so illegal aliens, mostly from the third world, who are now unlawfully residing in North America. At that point, when Obama and his Jewish handlers try to legalize all those beaners and whatnot from Indonesia and Haiti and Somalia, I think it's going to be almost impossible to keep race out of the discussion. That amnesty thing is going to come to a head about this time next year, most likely, and then we are going to see some real fireworks, I think. But still in all, the fact is that most of the Tea Party people and the Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck listeners who comprise this growing grass movement of white resistance are in it for economic reasons and because their own economic ox is being gored. Many of them are out of work, and more will be as the months and the years roll on. Unemployment benefits are running out, and many of them are having their homes foreclosed on, and there doesn't seem to be any real recovery coming in any future that anybody can foresee. Grassroots conservatives know that something is very badly wrong, and they're starting to get a few vague glimpses and flashes of inspiration in their minds as to what. People like Limbaugh and Glenn Beck are giving them a little bit of the story in very diluted form, but these Tea Party types, I think, sense that there is a lot more they're not being told. I imagine that the reluctance of the establishment conservative types to come to grips with immigration is a dead giveaway. Bear in mind, organized conservatism serves the Republican Party, and the Republican Party serves capitalism, and it's capitalism that has brought the 30 million illegal aliens here. The main defect of these people's outlook is that they have almost no idea about the Jews or the ramifications of the Jewish question. Most of them either think Israel is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, or else all they know about Jews comes from watching that stupid movie Fiddler on the Roof. That's going to be one of our main roles in the coming years, to somehow bring these people to an awareness of the Jewish aspect of their problems. But to what end? The biggest problem of all is that grassroots Tea Party types still believe that the system can be salvaged. They still believe in traditional electoral politics. They still believe that they can vote their way out of their problems, and there are major efforts being made by the powers that be, notably Rush Limbaugh, to absorb these people into the Republican Party and prevent them from striking out on their own politically. So long as white people are mentally and spiritually trapped in these outdated and archaic forms of political thought, so long as they're unable to think outside the electoral box, so long as they still believe that the solution lies in pulling a lever in a booth for some guy in a suit, then there will never be any real change in society. There is simply no point in holding elections if there are no candidates who represent the white man's racial interests, and these Tea Party people need to be made to see that. Always remember, the primary purpose of democracy is to prevent change, to ensure that actual state power is always held and retained by the same class or group of people, even if different individuals are sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. Democracy is one of the most brilliant and effective forms of mass deception ever devised. The mighty Wizard of Oz with smoke and noise and mirrors and pay no attention to that little hook-nosed man behind the curtain. As long as conservatives and Tea Partiers and Ron Paulites and whoever refuse to acknowledge the issue of race and remain ignorant of the Jewish question, they will never be able to effect any kind of change, and things will keep on getting worse and worse and worse until the white race becomes extinct about a century from now. Okay, time for another music break. I think I'll play some more of that thar furrin stuff for you. Anyone who ever saw the movie Waterloo or the Sharp's Rifles series will remember this one, but I believe it is, in fact, a genuine march from Napoleonic times. La Marche de la Vieille Garde, the March of the Old Guard. We'll be right back. Okay, now it's time for me to get down to the nitty-gritty of the basic differences between revolutionaries and conservatives in the context of white America, and why it's so absolutely essential that the white resistance movement develop a radical separatist tendency, specifically the Northwest Front, and why we need to persuade conservatives to change their thinking and change their behavior. The fact is that we have tried conservatism, and it doesn't work. Everything from Wallace for President to the John Birch Society to Reaganism to Ron Paulism, and none of it has had any lasting effect or produced one jot of genuine change. Not once in the past 60 years has the empowered liberal and Jewish elite establishment been forced to change their behavior in any significant way or to abandon one destructive and anti-white policy. In America, the essence of conservatism is learning to lose like a gentleman. For the past 60 years, the overwhelming majority of white people involved in right-wing and racial causes have not been revolutionaries, nor for that matter have they even been particularly radical. What most of the Tea Party people are is what's known as reactionaries. They are reacting to conditions of life which I concede are rapidly becoming intolerable in Obama's America and which are going to get worse. They are reacting as human beings naturally do to insult, oppression, and injury. They are lashing out in anger and hate at their tormentors. Now, this is entirely understandable, but personal economic grievance and racial resentment are not a political program or world view. The uncomfortable truth is that if times were to get better, and gas were to drop below $2 a gallon, and these people were given back their $100,000 a year jobs and their SUVs and their suburban tract houses, 98% would vanish from politics like the morning dew as the sun rises. Few of them, and few enough of us, have sufficient geopolitical education and intellectual depth to analyze an entire economic, political, and social system and realize that it's evil to the core. We're not Europeans. That kind of thing is too faceless and too abstract for us. We Americans like our politics like we like our fast food burgers, cased in styrofoam, loaded with cholesterol and additives that'll kill us, and smothered in fatty condiments and sauce. We don't want to do anything that requires too much analysis and thought. Americans don't like to think too much. It hurts our heads. Indeed, we have never been taught to think at all. We've been taught to feel, and that's not the same thing. So, like good Americans, conservatives, and even a lot more of advanced movement types, take the easy way out. We focus on individual issues like Obamacare, or in our own movement, we focus on one of the minority groups we particularly despise, or a single issue like guns or abortion or the Federal Reserve, and we don't worry about the system that has created this living hell from the ground up. The Tea Partiers badmouth Obama and Nancy Pelosi, but not the system that forced Obama and Pelosi on them in the first place. A lot of us in the so-called racial right hate the niggers or spicks or Jews or faggots, and we never stop to think how and why they got to be where they are and doing what they're doing. I've said it before, guys, there are only two real issues confronting us today. What the Jew is doing and why we are letting him do it. That's what we have to understand, and that's what we have to make these Tea Party conservatives understand. Neither of our movements particularly love those of our own race, as witness the Tea Partiers' desperate and futile attempts not to be portrayed as wicked racists and Nazis in the media, and the long string of white people most of us movement types very loudly revile and attack for religious or ethnic or cultural reasons. We just hate people who are different from us, and most of this hatred is born out of personal frustration, disappointment, loss of job or home, or terrible immediate injury. Not that these reasons for becoming politically involved are necessarily invalid. Now, since genuinely spiritual and ideological human beings have always been quite rare, personal reasons like this will most likely always constitute the majority of the motivation in any political movement. When a white man loses his job because of affirmative action, has his home foreclosed on, has a loved one butchered by niggers, or a child dragged into drugs and race mixing by the filthy Judaic culture, or he's victimized by our vile court system in some way, or when his daughter presents him with a mulatto grandchild, or when his son can't get into college because of the racial quotas, when he's forced into daily contact with buggery and third world filth, and when he watches a loved one stripped bare of a lifetime of work and savings because they or someone in their family were so unfortunate as to get sick. These are powerful motivations for wanting to attack the system that allowed these things to happen. But the overwhelming majority of white people who are involved in right-wing and racial causes and grouplets do not want genuine systemic change. They don't want to change the system. They want revenge on the system, which is not the same thing. They get involved, hoping to right their personal wrongs, not their people's wrongs. That may be understandable, but it will only take us so far. Put another way, most of us don't really want to change every aspect of America from top to bottom and turning it into something new. Most of us, if the truth be known, probably don't even see that much wrong with the system itself and prefer the devil we know. What we really want is for the existing system to work right, meaning work for us personally. We want the system to give us our props, as the Whiggers say. We want the existing order to keep its promises. We don't want to overthrow the establishment. We just want our share. We want the American dream, which was promised to us and which has not been delivered. We want everything to be the way it was, or the way we think it was, in some far-off, dimly perceived, idyllic past, in the time of abundance. Now, for my generation, it's the 1950s, with Bobby socks and Ozzie and Harriet in cardigans and rock around the clock. For many of you, it will be the 1960s or 1970s. Okay, in a way, I can kind of get the nostalgia for the 60s, although I was there, and I can tell you the 60s weren't all that they've been cracked up to be, but I was really freaked out when that stupid TV series, That 70s Show, came out. I mean, nostalgia for the 70s? Jimmy Carter? Disco? Give me a break. Anyway, what most white people really want out of all this is the good things in life that we have now or used to have, or that we've been socially conditioned to want. We want the money and the shiny high-tech toys. We want the SUVs and the football games on TV. We want the backyard barbecue and the vacations at the beach or the lake. We want the family trips to Six Flags with the screaming kids in the back of the SUV. We want that good old-time religion that we learned at our mother's knee. We want mom and God and apple pie and the red, white, and blue. We want politicians and preachers in expensive suits to come on TV and tell us everything is fine and we can enjoy ourselves without feeling guilty or worrying about anything. And of course, we want the beer. Gotta have that cold brewski in the fridge. And at the same time that we want to have all of this other stuff, we want to have none of the bad things. No crime, no drugs, no niggers, no Mexicans, no faggots, no feminist bitches, no lawyers, no scummy street corner lefties, no liberal talking heads on TV, no non-white faces on the tube or in the stores, not the constant sounds of Spanish and Tagalog and whatever weird languages they bring over from Booga Booga Land. We want everyone around us looking and thinking like ourselves, and that is natural, that is human, and I'm not trying to knock it. I'm simply trying to tell you guys that you can't have it. In our gigantic naivete, we think that somehow this is possible, but it isn't. We think that somehow we can vote ourselves this wonderful imaginary world if we just believe the right politician in a suit and a $200 haircut, but we can't. There will be no return to the time of abundance. That time is over. We can't click our heels 3 times and say, there's no place like home, there's no place like home, because we're not wearing ruby slippers and there is no Kansas to go back to. There's no Oz either. The Wicked Witch has taken over. The Scarecrow's OD'd. The Tin Man's been stolen by Puerto Ricans and chopped down for parts, and the Munchkins are butt-fucking each other on the Yellow Brick Road. We are living in a nightmare, and we will not wake up from it. History's clock moves forward, not backward, people. The old America we grew up in is gone forever. There is no going back. We have to figure out how we're going to move forward. Okay, since I still have some more raving to do, let's say we have a third music break. Something Celtic, but not Irish, I think. This is the Vale of Athol Pipe Band. Okay, the first thing we and the conservatives must rid our minds of is this idea that somehow we'll be able to take back the entire United States of America. If there is to be any hope for any kind of survival on this continent for white people and for the Western civilization we've created, then it lies in some form of secession. Listen very carefully, people. Read my lips. We will never be able to take back the entire United States because we have left it too late. We in our movement screwed around for 60 years and wasted our time on dead-end leaders and dead-end ideas. And yes, I include myself in that indictment. I was part of it too, have been for the past 37 years. I at least am capable of learning from my mistakes. There is nothing left to take back. It's gone. There are simply too many of them and not enough of us. Too many niggers, too many Mexicans and other illegals, too many bugger boys and carpet munchers, too many white women who have been damaged beyond repair by feminism, too many liberal left-wing dumbasses, too many pale-skinned dumbasses of our own race who are hopelessly brain-dead and who can't be reached because their minds and their thought processes have been destroyed by the television and the personal computer and the thousand and one lies of the Jews. Too many of them and not enough of us. In order to restore any semblance of the old USA, we would have to kill or forcibly expel from the North American continent at least 60 million people, more likely closer to 100 million people. How are we ever going to do that? How? All you guys out there who send me emails telling me I'm wrong and we mustn't engage in secession and that we have to infiltrate and take over the Republicans, whatever the hell, explain to me, how is this going to happen? The military? Is some general suddenly going to develop a conscience and stage a coup and drag Obama's black ass out of the White House and Pelosi's skanky, diseased ass out of the Capitol and then turn his troops loose on the Mexicans and drive them out? Would he be obeyed if he did? Who do you think makes up the rank and file of the U.S. military these days? Do you think white people are going to just simultaneously rise up and throw all this garbage out of the country? Who? Who's going to do that? A bunch of middle-aged men with big bellies who spend their time emailing news media articles to one another telling each other how bad things are? A bunch of old people in their wheelchairs and their walkers who don't want to pay taxes? Young white punks who, like Vernon said last week, do nothing except sit around listening to rap music, play in their Game Boys, and live with their mothers until they're 30? And are white people as a whole fit to do this, should the spirit ever move them to do so? How many white males today can even run up a flight of stairs without getting out of breath? Granted, a lot of white people still own firearms. But do they know how to use them in an actual military situation? I've seen real war, and I can tell you right now, no, they don't. This won't be a movie, you know, when a couple of Generation Xers and bimbos in tank tops shoot zombies for an hour on film and then ride off into the sunset on motorcycles or whatever. Guys, this take back all of America for white people thing, not happening. We had damned well better start thinking up another plan. Oh, wait, we have one. It's called the Northwest Imperative. We have been raised from birth with the idea of one nation indivisible under God, which is codswallop. Nowhere is it chiseled in stone by God or anyone else that the North American continent absolutely must be politically united into one national entity for all eternity until the crack of doom. Manifest destiny is horse dung. History and human realities don't work like that. Anything and everything is possible for mankind. Human beings create their own reality, and we have to create a new one here in the Northwest. The internet columnist Edgar Steele always closes his nickel rants with, "New America, an idea whose time has come." Well, I've got a better idea. End America, an idea whose time has come. Every other continent on the face of the earth has many countries on it, and eventually so will our continent. That's just the way it's going to work out. That's the way human nature will shape this up. A century from now, North America will be almost like the old South Africa with Bantu stands. The Southwest, from Southern California to Texas, will be Aztlan. There will be a Republic of New Africa in what's now the South, unless the Hispanics push in from Aztlan and kill or enslave all the niggers, which they may well do, like they've done in other places like Brazil and Central America. There may be some remnants of the United States left in the Midwest and the Northeastern Corridor. In theory, ruled over by some decrepit remnant of the Washington, D.C. government, but independent, in fact. And there will be a Northwest American Republic for white people only in the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, western Montana, and, with any luck, bits and pieces of Northern California, British Columbia, Alberta, and Alaska. it will be there 100 years from now, because we are going to make it so. Right now, the Northwest Front is sifting, sifting, sifting like a prospector panning a stream, looking for that little bit of color in the bottom of the pan. A large part of the people we're sifting are going to be conservatives connected to the Tea Party movement, or maybe not. But like the Marines, we're going to be looking for a few good men and women. We're going to be looking for men and women who have a few brain cells to rub together and who can see that despite all the Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh crap, the old America is gone forever and we have to start over. We will be sifting through 100 batches of contacts and keeping and nurturing the 2 or 3 out of each batch who seem to have a little bit of character and a glimmer of understanding. All I can do is keep begging you white folks out there to look in that mirror, and if you don't like what you see, then don't turn away. You know what you have to do. It's not that you can't do it. It's that you won't do it. But you can change that. The road is open for you to be a man again. The road of courage and self-worth, of pride and honor, and eventually of glory lies open for you just as much as it ever lay open for any Aryan man since the dawn of time. The road Northwest. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenbaum. Freedom.